Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
So I want to just get into some LA stories with you to get us going, and kind of hear about your history with this town, because it seems like you've got a lot of memories around every corner when we're driving around. You're like, oh, this happened there. I guess tell me first of all about your friendship with Ross, who was probably your first sort of close friend, right? When you moved out here, he was the guy that you connected with first. Would that be true?
He was one of the first guys that was interested in my band at the time, yeah. And we became really good close friends then. And yeah, he just, back then, it was the very beginning state. It was after Christian Death, the band I was in when I first moved out here. I started thinking it was after my first band called Disorderly Conduct, which is a hardcore punk band. And then I had just started an idea for a band called Amen, started playing around. And at that time, we were playing around a lot with a band that was called Creep, who was Korn under a different name with a different singer at the time. And Ross was working with them. The singer of Creep was a big fan of what we were doing. So he turned me on to Ross. And Ross was like, dude, I love your band. I want to record your demo. And I'm like, cool, let's do it. So that's the way it all began.
Weren't you telling me once that he asked you to maybe think about being the singer in Korn?
Yeah, I mean, at first he mentioned, like, they were looking for a singer and to, you know, kind of see if I was interested. But they're, you know, a funky band. I'm not much of a funky guy, so I'm a little more of a punk rock guy.
Yeah, yeah.
Metallic, punk, whatever.
So that didn't happen?
No, no.
Did you entertain the idea at all?
No, I was pretty headstrong in those days of what I wanted to do. And I just, for me, music was always about just expression. And I felt like they already had their expression. They had their writers, they had a band of friends that had been together for a long time. So that was totally cool. Hats off to them, you know. I just had to do my thing. Because for me, it didn't matter if it was going to be popular, if it was going to be, I just had to get the shit out of me.
Early on for you, I guess punk was like the light bulb, wasn't it, that set you off. I wonder if you could tell me about, you know, your history with that style of music, what it means to you, and how the first love of punk came around.
Well, for me, I grew up in New York, and then my mother decided to move to Florida, in the backwoods of Florida, like Deliverance Town, you know, swamp. And I didn't get along with people at all. Everybody kind of took the piss on me and was like, with my accent from New York. And so music to me was kind of the enemy's tool. I really hated music because you heard Freebird and all the 70s rock and shit I just didn't identify with at all. And I went to a skateboard competition back then, and I was in, and it was a really big competition where they had pros from around the world. Really, really amazing event. And it was a week-long event, and they roomed people with other skateboarders, so you'd be like roommates with somebody. So ironically, they roomed me up with Dwayne Peters, a skateboarder that I really, really admired, because he was full of life in his images. He had like a punk rock image, even though I didn't really understand it or anything. It was so for me when he when we got in the room together, he goes, "Hey man, you like punk rock?" I'm like, "What's that? What's punk rock?" He goes, "Music, man. You like music?" I go, "Oh no, I hate fucking music." And he goes, "Why the heck do you hate music?" And I'm like, "Oh man, the people everywhere I hate, they hate they love music, so I hate it." So he goes, "Oh, well, you'll love this." Puts in a cassette tape on his big boom box he had, and it was, I'll never forget it. It was a song by Black Flag called "Police Story," and the lyrics were, "Fucking city run by pigs. They take the rights away from all the kids." And I was like, as if I saw God's asshole open up. It was like the fucking universe to me, you know. It was beautiful. I was like, how can you say that? How can you do that? It was so noisy and full of life and energy. I was just like blown away. So I was completely addicted to it from that point on.
And you got a photo on your wall behind us, which I'll share a link to, because that's out there in the world, isn't it? It's on the internet.
Which one,
the Henry Rollins one.
Oh, right.
And
sure,
he's kind of gurning his face off, holding a mic down. And you're not even looking at him. You're kind of just gazing off into space as if you're possessed.
I'm kissing his cheek. I'm kissing his cheek is what I'm doing. I'm kissing him.
That night right there must hold 1,000 memories to set the scene.
That was, well, Henry had a television show and... he had, I mean, to me, it was like one of the best shows ever because he mixed all kinds of elements of art and important pieces on culture and whatnot. And he had everybody from Iggy Pop to every to Queens of the Stone Age to that, to Drive-In, you name it. They were on his, and he asked me if I would perform on there. And he just said, I'm like, I couldn't believe it. I'm like, he goes, "I just want you to do fucking full blown." He goes, "I'm uncensored and it's fucking whatever you want to do. I want you to fucking do your thing." And I'm like, "Okay." So that's what we did. And that was the photograph after we were wrapping up that day.
Oh, sorry, dude. You're talking about a completely different photo. I was talking about that one up there.
Oh.
You just thrown in a fucking jewel and a gem and a
okay,
bonus story.
Okay, so no, yeah.
Yeah, I was like, kissing his cheek. No, so the gig photo when you're what, like 10 there? How old are you there?
I was 12 in that photo, and that was the first punk rock show I'd ever seen. It was Black Flag, yeah.
That was your first gig?
First gig.
Wow.
Yeah. And, yeah, that was the first show I ever seen. I went early because I was corresponding with Chuck Dukowski at the time and met the band and was just, I'd never seen anything like that. To this day, it was still one of the most powerful things I'd ever witnessed in my life.
Was it an all-ages show or did you sneak in?
It was... I'm pretty sure it was a 21 and over because in Florida at that time, first of all, it was in Daytona Beach. And it's, there weren't really all ages things going on so much back then. If they were, they were on a different level. And I was just new to the scene, so I wasn't that aware of what was going on, to be honest with you. So that was a show in a bar that they snuck me into. And
who are the band did?
I actually think it was the band and maybe some of the guys I was with, too.
Right.
It was just sort of like, oh, he's friends with the band or that type of thing. I don't really remember. But
did you find yourself hanging out with all the kids because you were a skateboarder and these were the guys who were your friends?
Well, you mean that day?
Yeah.
That day, there weren't any kids. It was all, like, older dudes.
Right.
Yeah, like, everybody I went with was, like, you know, 21 and over.
Yeah, yeah,
skater
yeah.
Skater guys, punk guys. So, yeah, it was a great fucking day.
Tell me about your history with Danzig and Misfits. What did that band mean to you growing up? Were they another band
really
that you had early?
Well, because Henry had the tattoo of the Misfits, so I was interested in the Misfits, and I got turned on to them and I loved them, and I just started, because in Florida you couldn't buy these records, you couldn't get these records anywhere, and you'd have to correspond with the bands or the label or whoever and write to them and try to get. So I used to write to all those guys, like Ian MacKay and Glenn Danzig, mainly the SST office for Black Flag and all the various releases they were putting out.
Just handwritten letters.
Oh, yeah. And yeah. I still got a lot of them, as I was telling you. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it was interesting. It's interesting, you know, now in retrospect, especially, because who had ever thought, you know, Misfits just headlined the Forum, you know what I mean? Who would have ever thought back then, you know, you're dealing with a couple hundred records now.
They're like a global institution, aren't they? I mean, even that skull logo if you don't know the band, you probably know of that. How do you feel about stuff like that as a, you know, someone who prides themselves, I guess, on authenticity and integrity, and that connection for you is very real. How do you feel about, say, you know, a band like the Ramones or Misfits that become almost like brand logos, mm-hmm. and you see people obviously wearing the shirts and maybe don't have any connection to the music? Does that sit weirdly with you, or do you not really care?
For me, it's better if somebody is into, I mean, I don't know, if somebody is not into the band, they just want to wear it to be a hipster or whatever, if they don't know and they're just like, oh, I like that logo. I don't know. I don't care, but I think it's cooler than wearing a, you know, let's say a Fog Hat t-shirt or some flavor of the month band this year. You know what I mean? So I think it's cool.
At least it's out there.
Yeah.
Right there, you've got David Bowie on your screen. I'm just drawing from the room before we evolve and go any further. You were telling me the other day, along with Iggy Pop, who we'll talk about in a bit as well, he was probably, you know, your all-time hero, right?
I find David Bowie to be probably, when it comes to the term artist, musical artist, and artist in general, I think he's probably the king of, in my book, for my personal taste. He's flawless. The work he did in the 70s alone is just... You just sit in awe of it. It's just so massive and so genius and brilliant. And how many times he changed his character, and every single thing he did was just brilliant to me. I mean, there was some stuff in the 80s, like most bands that were from that generation, they would get a little more commercial because of the MTV generation, but he still did quality work. It wasn't as much, I wasn't into it as much as I was the prior stuff, but he's one in a billion. There'll never be another David Bowie. History of the world, there will never be somebody like that, of that caliber. And I honestly believe that the people like Lemmy and Iggy Pop and all these, and Lou Reed and all these people, these full of life characters, will never exist again because of an astounding amount of reasons. But I just don't think that quality of people don't exist anymore.
Do you think because art is so much more disposable in today's age?
I think that what's happened is, from my personal view, is that people, there were, back in the day, there was a thing called artist development, and there was something where labels would invest into someone like David Bowie, let's say, where they believed in his vision, and he was able to make a living creating, doing his job, which was creating art. That has obviously been gone for many years now, and hence it makes it more difficult for quality work to come out because people can't survive. So I think it's and everything today is so easy with the internet. It's a real like, there is no suffering. As far as like anything you want is at your fingertips. Of course, there's suffering when it comes to pain or whatever. But when it comes to like music, and you really want to strive, like I used to drive hours to buy a record, one record, just to find that one record. Now you can just download it for $1 on the internet. And but it's a different thing, you know. I think I like action. I like going out of your way and suffering for something, and it makes it much more enjoyable for me at the end.
Yeah, there's that element of discovery, mm-hmm. which makes it so much more exciting, doesn't it? I remember when I first discovered punk rock, you'd read all the liner notes and see who the bands thanked. And then you'd, you know, if, say, three bands all thank the same band, then you'd go out and check that out.
That's exactly right.
And that's how pre-internet you discovered new bands, wasn't it?
That is.
And you can't find out anything about them beyond what's in the Kerrang interview that week. You know, trying to just get information about these people. And I guess when you said earlier about how big stars like David Bowie and Lemmy probably won't ever exist again, I think it's hard for them to exist when you can find out anything about anyone at any time, right?
Well, I also think that that's going to be all across the board, especially when it comes to even actors. Look at the quality of actors that are around today who are the stars versus 10 years ago or 20 years ago. The quality of work is so not even a tenth of what it was back then, because people really fucking worked hard. You know, you're talking about having to put a lot of effort into something for your craft versus putting it together, let's say, on Pro Tools, mm-hmm. where you don't even have to play a full song. And you don't even have to have, know how to play an instrument, basically. You could just... I don't know. I guess it's fun for kids or people or whatever. That's cool. It's just... I haven't found anything that's really inspired me that way.
You had some times with David Bowie, right?
Yeah, I had the opportunity to meet him several times and have dinner with him and stuff, yeah.
What did you learn from someone like that when you're up close and in their company?
How you love this person, their music growing up, and once, for me, most of the people that I've met that I've really grew up admiring, it was no wonder once I met these people. It was as if you knew them forever, and it was as if you had a connection to them because everything they were communicating about that you connected with, there was a reason for that, is because you connected with that individual who created that art. And I think that 9 times out of 10, these people are the most beautiful people you've ever met, and it's like, and sometimes you end up being friends with these people and they take you under their wing. Or I've had a lot of that happen in my life, where these people that I never even dreamt about meeting, let alone talking to, would actually call me or want to do something with me, or, you know, be involved with. It's just, it's for that, in that terms of life, I've definitely had one of the richest lives for my life. Beyond my dreams, you know, getting to work with people that I've truly, truly think are the highest, most elite individuals that ever created the art.
And Iggy Pop.
Yep.
There was some real kind of creative magic going on between the two of you, right?
Well, we got together. There was a point where Ross was going to produce the record, I believe, and he asked me to write it. So, you know, we ended up working together and meeting up and listening to some of his songs and exchanging ideas and playing songs together, and made a bunch of demos. And unfortunately, the record never came to be for various reasons, but everything was beneficial, because at the end of it, Ross was like, dude, you got to keep these songs. These songs, even if this Iggy thing goes through, you got to keep some of these songs. These are like the best things you've ever done. And a lot of those songs went on to be a record we released called We Have Come For Your Parents. So it turned out all for the better.
Right on. And his son became your tour manager.
Yes, right. Eric, his son, became our tour manager and the funnest tour manager of all time.
Does he sound like Iggy? Does he talk like Iggy? Because that voice is so distinct. I wonder if that's something that is in the gene.
Yeah, he does. Like I said, he looks like a giant Iggy. He's like 7 feet tall, practically. And he's just a real character, just like Jim. Just like real, real, really amazing dude.
Was Lemmy a good friend of yours, and was it...
I was friends with Lemmy, definitely. Yeah, I mean, definitely through the years, you know, we'd always see each other and stuff, and we hung out several times, more than that probably, in L.A., you know, and definitely was a friend, yeah.
Were you friends with him in the drinking days? Did you...
Oh, yeah.
Cut loose
with him? Oh, yeah. Yeah? Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, definitely many nights with Lemmy, that's for sure.
Any you care to share?
Oh, man. I don't know. You know, you can just imagine. I mean, it's just, he was the best. You know, that week was like, to me, one of the most iconic weeks of misery, because two of the greatest people two of my top five, you know, people that create art and music, Lemmy and David Bowie, were dead in a week. And it's just like, there isn't a day that I don't miss hearing their voice or look forward to seeing them again or something. You know, they were really important to me as individuals that created something that was more powerful and more important than any politician ever did. And definitely were landmarks in history.
And it was right around Christmas time as well,
yeah,
wasn't it?
Exactly. Yeah.
A sad Christmas that year.
Yeah.
And it almost seemed to be the start of a huge wave.
Yeah.
Of deaths, and part of it is, I think, age, obviously, but then a lot of people have been passing away so young recently as well. It's been a real fucking dark couple of years, hasn't it, for losing...
Well, I think it's all because of the computer myself, but...
You do?
Yeah, I think a lot of artists, people that I know, people, it's becoming more and more difficult for these people that are creative entities not to be able to survive doing what they do. And it's pretty demolishing to someone who's an actual artist, because artists by nature are more sensitive, you know? So I think you see a lot of, you see a lot of the negative connotations from it.
Do you remove yourself from that world as much as you can?
Which one?
The old sort of social media realms.
Yeah, I mean, I really think it's amazing that people want to communicate and stuff, and I try to do that as much as I can, but it's almost like you... I didn't get involved. I was talking about this with a friend of mine. I didn't get involved in music to be a social butterfly. I didn't... not that I don't like people, and of course, the people that I get to meet through what I do are amazing people, of course. And I would love to hang out and love to do more things, but it's impossible. It's like, do I want to create or do I want to just hang out and communicate on a friendly basis? And I, like I said, I try to do both, but it's increasingly more and more difficult for me, because with the phone going off every 5 minutes, it's impossible to write a song. It's impossible to write lyrics if your phone's on. It takes you right out of that moment, and whatever you were thinking or whatever vibe you were on is destroyed the minute that phone goes off. For myself, I don't have that big of a brain, I guess. I just can't get back to that path that I was on before the phone rang. So it's difficult with all these conveniences and having to upgrade your computer. It's amazing. We're the slaves of the computer. We're the ones that have to do all the upgrading and all these updates and all this bullshit. And it's just like the amount of stuff you got to remember how to do on a computer. It's so much pointless information we wouldn't need to know if it wasn't mandatory to use in our day-to-day life. So it's a necessary evil, I guess. I try to limit it a little more, I think, than the average Joe.
Do you know one of my least favorite things is the automated phone service things, when you call up, say, your bank, and you and you just want to talk to a human, and you're on the phone for like fucking 10 minutes, and it's like, press 1 to speak about this, press 3, and you're like, just put a human on. Like, we could have done this and solved this in the time that I've been listening to all these different options just go on and on and on. It's that, fucking nuts.
It's my favorite thing in the world right there. When I'm in hell, when I go to hell, that will be my hell. I'll be on phone the entire time, and I'll be in a line of people who will be talking really loud about nothing and have no consciousness about personal space. So they'll keep bumping into you, and meanwhile, I'll be on the phone the whole time trying to, let's say, pay a bill. Like I did the other day, I had to pay something for my car. Every time they ask for my credit card, I was on the phone for over an hour, first of all. No human beings. Yeah. Impossible. You keep saying operator. They don't know the fucking operator. Nobody comes on alone. Every time I got to the end, I would say, okay, now to process your credit card. Every time I gave the number, they go, we do not understand that command. Can you repeat? And then they give you one more option, and then they disconnect on you. So then you have to go back on the phone for another hour. And do the whole thing again, and it did it twice to me. Twice.
Do you find yourself, like I do this, just literally screaming at this computer?
I find myself...
Like, fuck you!
I'm just like defeated. I'm like, of course that happened. Why would it not happen?
And you know you've just got to go through it all again.
Yeah, they're just... Fuck! Yeah.
Charles Bukowski... One of my all-time favorite writers, such a unique voice. Mm. Was he someone that you knew?
Yeah, I met him right when I moved, when I was 16.
When you were 16?
Yeah, when I was in California. Yeah, and I actually got to hang out with him at a bar that he used to be the local at, right across the street from a restaurant called Muccelli's in Hollywood, on Las Palmas. And they used to... let me go in there to this bar and hang out and just have drink Cokes. And then he bought me some drinks sometimes. And I have some books he signed for me and everything. You know,
amazing.
He was an amazing guy. And what a character, right?
What a character.
And brilliant writer. Brilliant. I mean, what fucking genius.
And was he someone who'd surround himself with a lot of people? Or was he more of a lone wolf kind of dude?
No, he was like, he'd show up at the bar by himself, maybe with a friend, or maybe some chick that kind of looked maybe like kind of not, maybe not a street girl, but mm-hmm. close. I don't know.
Maybe the girl that you wouldn't take home to meet your mother.
Yeah. He was amazing, man.
How do you become aware of someone like that at such a young age? Because I didn't get into him till super late. Right, because a lot of those bands were referencing his work. And
totally, and in publications back then with punk rock magazines, they exposed all kinds of art. That's what makes punk so important, because it would expose not just about the regular Sex Pistols, Clash bands. There'd be other articles on art, writers, fashion, whatever. It was all about exposing real shit that was punk rock in other cultures and in other facets of art. And I felt that was really important to me. You know, you don't see that in metal magazines per se. Not that I have anything. I love metal magazines too, but I think with punk rock, there's definitely some publications, they want to turn you on to all kinds. Okay, you like this kind of music? Maybe you're going to like this kind of writer, you know? You know, the same way, like J.G. Ballard. I don't know if you know about him.
Of course, yeah.
See, I learned about him through, I think it was like Slash magazine even, because they used to have amazing articles. But yeah, you know.
What was the big magazine back in the day? Was it Maximum Rock and Roll? Was that an important one?
Well, you had Maximum Rock and Roll. You had Flipside magazines, which was the main ones. You had great magazines from Boston called Triple X, Fanzine, Suburban Voice. You had all kinds of public. I mean, before Flipside and before Maximum Rock and Roll was a magazine called Slash, was based out of L.A., who were the label that signed the Germs and were putting out a lot of, and signed a lot of, worked with a lot of artists. They had an incredible magazine, and they just put out like a compilation of their magazines, I believe, in a hardcover or something. But, you know, it was, that's the way I learned about so much other stuff, you know, like Bukowski and some artists like Basquiat and people like that, you know, at an early age, just from reading those articles.
I didn't know until like literally 2 days ago. I just watched this documentary that's coming out about Joan Jett called Bad Reputation. I didn't realize that she produced that Germs record,
yeah,
which is phenomenal.
Yeah.
Like, and she was such a champion for bands like Bikini Kill very early on as well. Like, I didn't realize how really hands-on she was within that punk rock community.
Yeah.
Almost like, I guess if you could call Lemmy the king of that world.
Yep.
Joan Jett's kind of basically the queen, isn't she?
Yeah, she's amazing. She's amazing. I mean, she's just going as hard as she was back then, even harder maybe now. You know, she's still out there playing and doing quality work.
Did you see the Germs perform? Did you ever catch them?
Oh, no, that was way before me.
Yeah?
No, but I definitely would say the Germs were one of my favorite bands of all time.
Straight up. What was it? Just the nihilistic kind of rawness, or?
You know, I don't know. I thought his lyrics were brilliant. I thought the fact that they were kind of like the Stooges was unpredictable. You didn't know what was going to happen. Can they even play? Who cares? You know?
Yeah.
You know, and the Decline, the movie, you see him singing, and, you know, you can't even read the subtitles to it because they don't make any sense. You know, it's like brilliant. I love that. It was a unique band, and they were definitely unbridled. And I thought they wrote great songs.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
And the British punk for you, did that come later or did it all happen at once? Because it was obviously kind of two separate scenes, really, wasn't it? The style was very different, I think, from both sides of the pond.
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, when I got into punk, I got into it all. You know, so it didn't matter where it came from. I was into punk bands from Indonesia. I was into punk bands from wherever. Japanese punk, I really love. And the UK, but the UK stuff, it's funny, in retrospect, you know, now a billion years later, the UK stuff actually stands up almost stronger than any other country for me, with especially when you're talking about bands like Killing Joke or you're talking about bands like UK Subs. I mean, there's a billion bands I could reference, but those are just a couple that I think is just like as if it still stuff isn't that good compared to what that was,
mm-hmm.
you know? It just isn't. There was something going on. I think culturally in the UK at that time, what was going on affected the music incredibly. And I think that's why so much strong music was coming out of the UK at that point.
What's your connection to the UK? Is it a place you...
Well, my parents are European, first of all. So I've always been a little bit more in tow with anywhere outside of America. You know, I'd never really seen eye to eye on a lot of things in American culture, and I just felt more comfortable in other countries. Every time I travel the world, I feel far more comfortable anywhere I go. So, you know, for me, I think musically, it was just they had a lot of stuff to say. They said it, and there was a certain like bravo about British punk, which not many other countries had. Japan did a little bit, but I think like with, for me in American punk rock, when you're talking like Stooges, it's just fucking sleaze, underbelly, industrial, fucking just full blown power, like, Brits kind of, with two flying V's and a fist up your ass, you know?
And a mouthful of gold.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So I don't know, you know, but I think culturally with what was happening in the world at that time in the UK with the strikes and all that stuff going on and politically what was going on even more so really affected the music.
And obviously a lot of those guys have become, you know, friends of yours as well. Do you like hanging out with British people?
I would say I probably have more British friends.
Yeah.
Than anything else. British definitely is up there, yeah. I would say British people I get on with really well. And I just got back from the UK, and I had probably one of the best trips I ever had. You know, it was incredible. Just,
I was sorry to miss you on it.
I know. Yeah,
we got to hang out my side, man. Yeah, we got to hang out my side.
Of course we will.
You're always showing me around your side. And I mean, for me, it's crazy because a lot of those American bands didn't last long, did they? I kind of burnt very brightly for a short period of time, either broke up or death kind of took people away or whatever. But with a lot of these British bands, aside from the Pistols and the Clash, I mean, you look at the Damned, who just put out a new record this year. Buzzcocks still at it. UK Subs still at it. Tim, TV Smith, and the Adverts still at it. The list is kind of endless. Almost all of those bands, in one way, shape, or form, are still doing it. Like, not just doing the kind of nostalgic tours either, but releasing new music.
Absolutely.
Like, just fucking absolute lifers.
Mm-hmm. That's the way to do it. I mean, why not? If Kansas can do it, why can't it's UK Subs? You know, more power to Charlie, always.
Let's talk about your friend Dane Carr. So we're going to be going out later with him. He was just on the show a couple of days ago as well. He asked me to ask you about the time that you, him, and Ross Robinson got arrested and spent the night in jail.
Oh, God. He didn't tell you about it?
He put it on you.
Oh,
he was like, you ask Casey about it.
Thanks, Dean. yeah, it was like, it was funny because I had become really close friends with Dean, and I was friends with Ross for a long time, and it was crazy to me. They never met. It was just so strange. I'm like, all right, that's it. This is preposterous. I'm saying we're going to Vegas this weekend. The three of us jumped in a car, went to Vegas, ended up in jail in the middle of the next later that night. It was just funny, but the cops were cool. It was just some stupid bullshit, but it was funny because the cops were super cool and they were laughing about the whole thing. They were like, this is, it was some hotel rule or something. I don't even remember. But they took a bunch of Polaroids of us and like hanging out with the cops, and we were like just all dingy and dirty and laying on the
plane
floor
up to the ledge.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. Like, as if we were convicts in San Quentin or something.
Did they know who any of you were, or did they just think
so.
These guys are fucking interesting, fun dudes? Let's
yeah, we were
fun.
Just cool about it. We weren't like trying to be macho or something like that. We were just like, okay, whatever you say, boss. You know, I'm having a good time. They were having a good time. That was it.
And you and Dean had a friend, the woman, I can't remember her name. You were telling me about her the last time I was out here, who used to be head of Universal.
Oh, no, Nancy Berry. Nancy Berry was the head of Virgin, right?
Like a big, big, big player in
yeah,
the record.
Well,
industry.
She was married to Ken Berry.
I guess through a friendship with someone like that, you really go behind the curtain into that world as well, right? And see all the
excess.
And
I mean, I owe so much to Nancy Berry. To me, she was the last bastion of hope from commerce and art, because she would invest in signing a band like Amen and also Spice Girls and Bowie and Lenny Kravitz and all these different types of artists, and be able to balance it all, and knew how to treat her artists. And just when you think of those rock and roll decadent parties and stuff like that, she knew how to take care of business and take chances. And if it wasn't for her, this band definitely wouldn't have had a smidgen of a shot as much as it did.
And that was purely and simply down to her belief in
right.
you and what you were doing.
Yeah. I mean, she, because we were friends also before Dean and I knew her, before Amen ever signed, and even before we signed the Roadrunner, she was interested in signing the band. And I'm like, well, you know, I don't want to compete with Spice Girls and all this stuff. I think, you know, we'll be kind of forgotten.
Mm-hmm. Low down the pecking order, yeah.
Yeah, so I figured we did our first record, and then after that, then we went to Virgin. So that was great.
And was that a taste for you of sort of the last days of the record business?
Well, we went signed to Sony after that, which was still kind of that, but it was nothing compared to being signed by Nancy, you know, on Nancy's label through her. And yeah, I mean, you get definitely a... It was definitely special.
Do you look back at all those days with a fond...
Oh, man.
Fond memory? It seems like you were right there at a time, particularly in this city, with people like Ross and Dean as well. Like, all your friends were just involved in the coolest shit that was going
Absolutely.
On.
Absolutely.
You were right there on the pulse.
They were all there. They were all there doing shit. And that's I think, where the... You know, what I really love about... the city is that you run into people who are taking care of shit, doing shit, making shit happen, and it doesn't matter what they do, it's just, and you get on, because it's just sort of you know, that's what I really loved about hanging out with them. They were so creative and inspiring to me. They were doing so much incredible work, and I found that inspiring.
And you were obviously around, were you around bands like, say, Manson and Slipknot and all these bands?
Well, yeah, I mean, Slipknot and us recorded our first record at the same time in the same studio with Ross. I went over, like, I blew my voice out recording the Amen record, the first Amen record. So Slipknot was booked, like, the day after our time was up. But Ross was like, why don't you stay up here? Because we were living in a studio up in Malibu, which was in the middle of the mountains. So I just stayed up there. Slipknot came early, and they were hanging out with us while we were still recording. We became friends. And then when they were done recording during the day, I'd go in and do vocals. So, yeah.
That's wild. And then even later on, I mean, Ross was such a a key figure in so many like sub-genres and musical movements, wasn't he? And later on, of course, there was like Glassjaw and At the Drive-In, and you were around a lot of all of that action as well.
Yeah, of course. I mean, when I was in town, definitely, you know, there was some, like, I brought a band to him he signed called Blood Brothers.
Yep.
I found them and just hip Ross to it, figured he'd like them. So, I try to, we were friends, so we were hanging out a lot, you know, whenever I was in town.
What's your memories of making those Amen records, being in the studio and, you know, because they're so raw and visceral and honest and powerful. And when you lay yourself out there that way, is it difficult? Is it sort of emotionally stressful? Is it cathartic?
Well, it's definitely cathartic. It's definitely, those days it was a lot of experience had to be put into making those records. Mm-hmm. So it definitely created a lot of problems for me in the long run, but I wouldn't have changed a thing because that's what we're here to do. We were supposed to use our bodies as tools to express. So I think I'm really grateful I had the opportunity to even make a record, let alone, you know, I would do anything I've consistently made music since then, so I consistently try to challenge myself on different levels. So I'm just grateful I was ever able to do those records.
And the touring side of things, is that where you feel most in your element, would you say? Live on stage, is that?
We haven't, I haven't played out for a long fucking lifetime. But there's been many, many records made and many, many things that's happened. So we'll see if people want it. We'll be back out.
People want it, dude.
We'll see.
People want it.
We'll see.
What's been keeping you from the stage? Has it been your health?
I mean, there's been health issues, but, there's a lot of other elements. I was involved with working with so many different people over the years and creating on different levels and doing different things. It's impossible to even think about how long it's been. And I just don't compromise. So like if I get involved in a record that I'm making and I lose interest, I pretty much put it away. Even though people go, that's the best record you ever made, it's still on the shelf because something, I detached from something along the way, and I don't believe in moving backwards.
Is there a lot of music like that over the years that you've started and never finished for that reason?
There's several albums, yes,
yeah.
Completed. Several that are completed and three that are incomplete.
And you won't ever put them out or
maybe,
share them?
Maybe one day, but for the first record that's going to come out, whenever it does come out, that one is recorded. I'm in the process of finishing it now. So anything else from prior to that, I'm sure we'll see the light of day in one way or another. I'd give it away for free. I don't care. I don't want the money from it. It's just a matter of like, they need to be mixed and stuff like that. They're not mixed. So, it takes money to do that. And I got to invest the money in the current record I'm making. So, it's a little difficult when you don't have the money from or the money to be able to finish them.
So you've just said that an Amen album is finished, is it?
Well, I'm working on one. There's three records that were completed that are near completion that were recorded over the last 3 years. So,
and we is who was the team involved with you?
Ross was involved with recording one of them. Another one, I was involved with doing with someone else. But it's all Amen material. It's all stuff I went in. Dave Lombardo plays drums on the record with Ross, and Shannon Larkin plays drums on some of that record as well. Roy plays drums on some of the other one that we recorded. So, Roy Mayorga. So I have the best drummers in the world.
Yeah, I was going to say right now.
I would say for my personal taste, my favorite three drummers. So I'm really pleased with that. So hopefully they'll get completed soon and we'll have a way to release it.
I love it. Well, I hope so.
Thanks.
And it's been a long time coming. I remember the last time we were out here.
I know. I know. Everybody tells me the same thing, and I know. It's a complicated life. It doesn't make sense to anybody, but do we do the best we can?
And how are you in yourself? Are you happy with where you are in life? Do you feel at peace?
Yeah, I mean, I'm definitely all right. You know, and I'm always all right. It's just, I want to be able to... I'm just grateful that I've been able to have the opportunity to do what I've done, and hopefully it'll continue. You know, we'll see what happens. Make some more noise if people want it. If they don't, I'll still make some fucking noise.
I love the way you say that. I've always been all right as well. I'll always be all right. You feel like there ain't anything life can throw at you that you can't overcome.
Well, I've died twice. I've definitely had an interesting life. So I'm not afraid, because I was given a death sentence when I was 16. They said I wouldn't live to be past 21. So I'm pretty grateful. And at the same time, it's a double-edged sword. Like, you know, and you just don't give a fuck. You know, you just got to go do what you're going to do, and whatever happens, happens. And live in total gratitude that you've given you the experience, and fucking ride that fucking thing out, whatever it is, to the fullest. Don't fucking half-ass shit, because everybody today, I don't know, for me, I see a lot of people half-assing shit. Like when I hear a band record the record and they don't even play through an entire song, it's all chopped together. That's shit. There's no craftsmanship in that. The reason we buy things, the reason people buy let's say a Rolls Royce or whatever these fancy cars are, is because of craftsmanship. And it's because it's the art that's put into it. When you're selling something that's more important, the most important artistic form is music. I don't give a fuck what anybody says, because it communicates to everybody. You couldn't watch a movie without music in it. You couldn't watch TV without music in it. You couldn't... There is no possible way there's... You could continue. I mean... I guess you could. People can live without music if they wanted to. But to the average guy, you need music in your life. It's something that translates, it cancels everything out and is an equal playing board. And you can, it doesn't matter where you come from, you can communicate on that level. And when you take the craftsmanship out of something that's so powerful and so important, music is such a ritual and it's so important, and you just fucking don't even take the time out to play an entire song or record it and just copy and paste and all this shit, it's the worst. It's like utter blasphemy. People talked shit about Milli Vanilli. Remember that fucking shit? Milli Vanilli were geniuses to most of the aggressive music bands today, because they don't even play their songs. You know what I mean? It's like, it's a crazy fucked up world. Who cares?
Who's your favorite person to sit down and talk about music with? Who is on exactly the same page as you? You got your spiritual music partner out there?
No, I don't know. I like talking to everybody about music because I like different opinions.
Because I think for me, I've never known anyone that is so in love with both metal and punk. Mm. And I guess that's what made Amen really special, wasn't it? Is kind of they are the perfect marriage,
is it,
of those two things. I think that's what made you guys unique, you know. Yeah. Because you're hard to categorize and hard to define, and mm-hmm. I think it's just because it's half of that and half of that, which is kind of you, isn't it? That's your...
Well, I think also the seems like thing that I mean, for me, you know, I was into a lot of other types of music too. I mean, like bands for me, like Gang of Four, mm-hmm. is like one of my favorite bands.
Fantastic band, yeah.
Because that guitar playing is so fucking brilliant. Is easily one of the most important guitar players to me, because he played in such a dissonant way and so unique and aggressive, and it was just... He created that sound. And for me, since I never knew how to play notes or anything, or I tuned my instruments different. I just created my own sound. And I think that's why it seems like Ross would always say it was why Amen was so unique, was I played everything on the records. So it has that unique sound where it's not like a normal technically efficient guitar player could play our songs, and it just doesn't sound right. It's just sort of like, he goes, why have an interpretation of the source when we have the source?
Yeah.
And you don't, you're so unorthodox. Nobody plays like you, you know, it's totally different. So
are you entirely self-taught?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I took one lesson when I was a little kid, and that was it.
Fuck this.
It just wasn't my thing. It was like he was trying to show me technical. I didn't want to be, I'm not interested in like finger hot licks and doing these
Eddie Van Halen
shit. Yeah, it's like, cool, they can do that, that's awesome. That's just not what I'm interested in. I just want to get this shit out of my soul, and I don't need to be technically some skilled guitar player to do that, you know. I can just use a 2x4 and a bass string.
Have you got a song that you're perhaps most proudest of?
No.
Above all others, is there a favorite child out there?
Every single song, everything, every time I get asked that, there'd be like, this is the greatest example of what happens with Amen. Every album, I record a shitload of demos. Like for the Parents album, I recorded 73 songs with Shannon Larkin. And then at the end of me demoing them all and with Larkin, we sit in my room with the band, and everybody has a sheet of paper except for me. I don't have a vote. I refuse to vote. So it's the four guys in the band that would, we'd all sit in the same room, put on a song, and at the end of the song, everybody wouldn't talk to anybody, and they just wrote down their number for the song, like 1 out of 10.
Right.
So whatever songs made the highest numbers would be the songs that made the record.
That's how you do it.
That's the way we did it. And I had no say, because I can't judge what I do.
You couldn't choose.
Because every time, back to the question you asked, which is my favorite, every time I say, oh, I love this song, like in that scenario, it would be the lowest ranked song, and it would have taken me like a week to write that song, as opposed to the song that I completely wrote spontaneously with Shannon in the room. I just go, okay, we don't know what we're going to play right now. Push record, go, hit a beat, and we'd write a song. That song was like the favorite song, as opposed to the one that actually took time out. So that's why I can't ever choose anything. You know, it's just sort of like, I do what I do, and you guys decide. That's cool.
Crazy. And then you would just be happy with that decision.
Yeah.
And you'd leave it down to their.
Yeah. I mean, I have a say in
judgment.
And when it came time, after they picked the songs, they trusted me to, you know, the album sequencing and all that type of stuff. They had their opinions too. But, you know, as far as picking the songs, I'm way out of it.
That's wild. How many songs you reckon you've written?
Jesus, I have no. A lot. There's a lot of. I mean, there's thousands and thousands and thousands of songs just on this computer alone.
Fucking hell.
Yeah. I mean, from when I was a kid to now. I mean, that's all I did as a kid, was just sit in that room with my little four-track cassette Tascam recorder and just demo songs. I do it to a drum machine. I do it trying to play drums myself, which is the worst thing you ever want to hear is me on drums. That's one thing I cannot play. But I'd do anything just to express, just to get it out of me. I had to get it out of me.
Apart from Amen, what's been your favorite sort of musical experience?
That's a good question. I mean, I would say, as far as, we had a little band with Josh and Nick from Queens of the Stone Age with Shannon and I, and Twiggy played bass, called Headband, which is very short-lived but very fun while it did.
What era would that have been?
That would have been when Queens were doing Songs for the Deaf. That's when I was doing Death Before Music. And then definitely one of my favorite things I've ever done is the record I did with in Norway with the guys from Emperor and Turbo Negro.
Emperor and Turbo Negro.
Yeah, it's called Scum.
Wow.
Record, and it's amazing.
Is that out?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was definitely one of my favorite things I've ever done. Getting asked to sing for the Damned for the anniversary show was incredible one night, but it was amazing. Every opportunity.
Did you get nervous?
I did, actually, yeah. Because there's so much, like, so much, there were so many terms, like Cockney rhyming slang and stuff like that, in the that I never knew. So having to retrain my thought, first of all, having to sing somebody else's lyrics is something I never did.
Ever.
I've never sang somebody else's lyrics. So that was a challenge in itself, and that made me kind of, let alone for like my favorite band.
Yeah, yeah.
So that was a challenge, but it was amazing. I mean, just working with Darren Malakian for Scars on Broadway, that was fun, even though...
Did you co-write, was it They Say?
No, BYOB.
BYOB.
Yeah.
Fucking hell. And yeah. That won a Grammy, right, that song?
Yes. I believe it did.
That's an incredible song.
It was fun. It was fun. I mean, there's just so many things.
You've worked with some fucking cool people.
Working with Raven from Killing Joke was always a blast. We worked a lot together. I mean, pretty long list of... Yeah.
Did you do one of the... It's not music-based, but it's kind of music-based. Did you do one of the radio voices on the Songs for the Deaf album?
Yeah.
Did you chip on one of them?
Yeah. That's when we were doing Headband, the side band I was just mentioning, yes.
That record, for me, is like one of the last great LA rock and roll albums. Well, California.
Mm-hmm.
And it just captures, I mean, the landscape, the kind of culture... And that band at that point in time were just fucking unstoppable.
They were brilliant,
weren't they?
We played shows like in L.A. We did like a show at the Troubadour, they opened for us under like a, we were wearing masks and stuff like that type thing. It was fucking amazing. But those guys were good friends, good guys, and an amazing band. Definitely a force.
Nick's been on the show. I love talking to him.
I love Nick.
He's a special guy, isn't he?
I think he's so unique.
He gets a really bad reputation for, you know, whatever one reason or another, but I found him to be a sweetheart.
He is. He's an angel. And the thing about Nick that's so brilliant is that he can sing as fucking brutal as possible, as anybody can, but he has perfect pitch, so he can sing an acoustic song like an angel. It's... such a unique talent, and he's so talented, and I love him. He's the best dude. He's definitely a great guy.
Are you close with Josh as well?
Yeah, Josh and I are friends too.
Yeah.
I don't see Josh as much though, because he is more busy and stuff.
Yeah. I mean, for me, I don't want to shit talk, but I think that band misses Nick, and the magic of the band was their chemistry, those two.
Yeah, I prefer the band with Nick in it.
Dude. Thank you for coming on the show.
Thank
finally.
You,
I've been looking forward to this for
my
a long
pleasure.
Time. I love hanging out with you. I love hearing your stories.
I love hanging out with you.
Shall we have a little smoke?
Let's do it.
And a big red?
Yeah, and a fist fuck.
Everybody's going to the party, have a real good time. Dancing in the desert, blowing up the sunshine. Everybody's gone to the party, have a real good time. Dancing in the desert, blowing up the sunshine.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50. Luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.